have interviewed. Do you want to press a little button? March 8th, 2012, and we're conducting the second interview with Donald Patterson, once again at the Patterson Building in the boardroom, Thunder Bay. And we're going to continue on with the interesting career of Don. We left off with some things unfinished related to his time in Winnipeg. So I think I'd like to start there with, you had mentioned just briefly in passing that your offices were in the grain exchange, and it put you in contact with a number of people in the grain and commodities exchange, and that they were interesting characters. So I'd just like to allow you some time to talk about those interesting characters and what you, what remains in your mind as memorable about them.
Yeah, there were a number of personalities involved, and it's interesting, throughout the evolution of the industry, I might have referred earlier to the fact that a lot of things were done on a handshake, that you gave somebody a commitment, essentially gave them your word that you were going to perform in terms of carriage of goods, in this case grain, and often that was good enough, and it happened to some extent in the grain industry. It certainly happened in the movement of iron ore and other commodities. But as time marched on, things became more formalized, and all for the right reasons, to really make sure everything was clear and that people were performing as they had promised. It was simply a natural progression of business. But as I had mentioned to you, there were a number of very colorful characters. I was a relatively young man at the time. I would have been 30 years old, between 30 and 33, and came into contact with other gentlemen doing the same sort of thing that I was doing in terms of grain chartering, working for the competitor companies. And we always fairly much considered ourselves friendly competitors. We all had to talk to each other. There were times when one company couldn't perform a certain charter, so somebody else would step in, and there was always a bit of a gentleman's agreement that you might trade back and forth a little bit, just because you needed the flexibility. And it really was a two-way street. It worked for everybody. Everyone was quite, there was a certain sort of gentleman's pact, if you will. Some of the names are escaping me, but you know, the fellows at Canada Steamship Lines and at Upper Lakes Shipping, and those who worked for Algoma Central Corporation, they really were a good bunch. They we came in contact with each other almost on a daily basis. It was a relatively small marine community, tightly knit in Winnipeg, and so you would come in contact with people as you came and went from the Canadian Wheat Board building, or as you moved in and out of the commodity exchange and the trading floor. You would bump into individuals, or if you were somewhere in what they called the concourse in Winnipeg, you'd see people having coffee, you'd stop and talk with them. It was interesting, and there were times when we played golf together, met at various meetings or conventions together, so it was an interesting community, and it was good to get to know people, because when you did have to rely on somebody, you knew you could trust them, and you also knew on the basis which you were dealing with them, it was competitive, but it was conducted in a reasonable fashion. I also sat on the board of the Traders Building, and I had mentioned that earlier. You said mm-hmm. you had met Bill Parrish Senior, and as a young man representing the Patterson shareholdings in what was called the Traders Building, which was 167 Lombard Avenue, which used to have the trading floor in it. It was gone by the time I got to Winnipeg, but the Patterson offices were still in that building, and we owned a pretty good percentage of the company that owned the building. And so I came into contact with Mr. Parrish. I learned a lot from him. He was He could be both gruff and friendly at the same time. It was an interesting combination. There were times I was a little intimidated, but as I said, I did learn a lot from him. He had great business acumen. He had he was very forthright. He had a great way of saying the way things really were. But nonetheless, he struck me as being quite a fair individual. And I served on that board with Percy Stapley, who was at the time the legal counsel for N.M. Patterson & Sons Limited, worked in the Patterson office, also served with my uncle Donald Patterson, who was the president of the Patterson Company at the time, the chairman of the company, and also president of the Traders Building Association, I think that's what it was called, even though it was a federally chartered company and had common shareholders. So an interesting time, and we did actually end up doing a transaction to buy that building and then sell the building.
I don't know if your memory is clear enough going back, but if you, I see you as the sort of the young kid on the block, and going in amongst these fellows, as you mentioned, have been around for a long time. So you stayed in that position how long, did you say?
I was there for 3 years.
Okay. So when you look back on those 3 years, what do you think was your major, the major learning that you gained, partially because of what you knew about these, what you knew at the end of the 3 years about these fellows who'd been there for a long time?
Well, the major learning was the introductions to... Well, the major learning was learning the Patterson business and developing a greater sensitivity to how much it took to keep the company running on an annual basis and how important it was to understand the function of the various people, not just at the executive level, but right through the organization. And then also all of the people that they were in working with throughout the industry, between the railways, the commodity exchange, competitive line elevator companies, the regulatory bodies, so the Canadian Grain Commission, the Canadian Wheat Board, which was the single desk selling representative for wheat and barley in Canada, and then all the other trading houses, the competitive trading houses that were doing trades in off-board commodities, so feed grains, mustard seeds, sunflower seeds, canola, rapeseed, all of those other commodities, all of which we carried on our ships. So the learnings of understanding how the Patterson Company worked, not just from a marine perspective, which was my background, but the grain perspective as well. So doing the commodity trading course at the Canadian International Grains Institute, and then so getting a much broader, broad brush perspective of what the industry really looked like. And then actually getting to know the people, getting to know the characters. So then when I did come back to Thunder Bay and move into higher executive positions within the company, I was familiar with people. I would see them at industry meetings, at when I was doing lobbying work on behalf of the marine industry in Canada, really knowing all the players in the game, knowing how they thought, what their functions were within their companies or the regulatory bodies or whatever they were. That was a huge leg on for me. It gave me a much broader picture of the industry in general and certainly our company.
So there was no naivety on your part that was sort of worked out of you
There was a lot of that. Because I was still very much involved in the Patterson Foundation and just something that I really loved to do. And so I would focus on that from time to time and maybe get a little lost within that. And Kurt Bennett, who was the vice president of Winnipeg Charters, would bring me back to earth. He would often come into my office and say, what are you doing? What are you working on? Have you done this? Do you know about that? Are you thinking about this? And he did it in a way that really did encourage me to understand the business. He was, in a lot of ways, he was my mentor for that part of the business, and I learned a lot from Kurt, and I developed a very a great respect for him, and we also became very great friends, I would think. And certainly got to know his wife Bev, who was became the manager of Lake Shippers Clearance Association, and we were guests in their home, and they knew our children, and it was more than just business.
And from what you've said, would it be a fair comment to say that being here in Thunder Bay before you went to Winnipeg, even though we're not that far away, it was fairly isolated here because you were not in touch with those,
well, it was
with a broader grain.
No question about that. Absolutely. And quite frankly, had not worked very long in the marine business per se, because of my focus on what was happening at the Royal Edward Hotel, what I was doing for the Patterson Foundation, what I was doing for my grandfather and Patterson Investments, and then the passing of my father. This was a good next step to learn and understand the business.
You know, maybe this is a good time to talk about some of the questions that are standard questions that we ask in circumstances like this, because you've raised a couple of the names. What was your connection with the Canadian Grain Commission? What did you learn about them that you might not have known had you not moved on to these positions that you moved
on
to?
Well, really, starting with the commodities marketing course, getting that little bit of knowledge and then looking at the industry, the broad industry, as it stood in that day, it really helped me understand what everybody did, how they all fit together. It was like a great big jigsaw puzzle. And prior to that, it was just all these disparate pieces. And by going to Winnipeg and immersing myself in that part of the marine business for Patterson and the grain business for Patterson, it helped me understand what it all, it gave meaning to it. It put it in perspective for me. So the Grain Commission, for example, Canada sells everything by certificate. So, you know, we knew what was going on board. We knew what was going on board because the commission said that's what it was. So to be able to understand all of that and speak knowledgeably to customers, to others in the industry was really, really important to really know, to have confidence in things that you were talking about.
Because the Canadian Grain Commission is a regulatory body, how would you describe the relationship? Was it a push and pull?
It wasn't adversarial, but it was, I guess in a way, territorial. That's what it was. It was territorial. So, you know, we'd have grain in store that was going on board, and you know, we'd say it was a certain grade, and the Grain Commission would come back and say, no, it's this grade, and we'd say, no, it's that grade, you know. So there was that, I guess it was a bit of push and pull, but it was the regular course of business, having we all shared core beliefs, which was the value of our Canadian grain, and it was just a matter of coming to finding common ground when it came to what was going in the ship, what was coming back out of the ship. That was the other thing. You put a load in, you know what you've got, you get to the other end, and somebody's saying, no, it's not grading out the same. Well, wait a minute, it's by certificate. Well, here are all the reasons why it's not grading the same. Or it's got bugs in it. Or, you know, so you put the bugs in. No, they must have been there because the ship was inspected, it was cleared, bugs weren't there. So there was a lot of back and forth that way.
Did that happen very often, or most of the time it was?
It was all part of the business.
Yeah.
You know, it was part of the business. The way that you're handling a bulk commodity, and it's a very fluid commodity. There are so many agencies and companies involved in the either the ownership or the handling of that commodity that you had to track it all, and you had to stand up for what you felt was your position. You had to be able to do that. You had to be able to do it knowledgeably.
I think last time we, in passing as well, you talked about the Canadian Wheat Board. Anything to add there?
Well, was an interesting relationship with the Wheat Board, and really on both sides of the business. The marine side, where we were, they were our customers, and on the grain side, where we were their warehousemen. So we were essentially acted as their agents. So we collected grain, we stored it for them. They paid us to do that. They carried the cost of that grain, and then eventually it moved on. So there were a couple of different defined relationships we had with the Canadian Wheat Board. They were, you know, they were fairly fair, I think, in terms of how they tried to balance their trades with the marine industry. It was obviously in their best interest to have a vibrant yet competitive marine industry. And so there was a constant flow of information, contact, negotiation, relationship building, relationship management with the Canadian Wheat Board. And as a young man, it was challenging at times for me to understand all of the implications of that association and how we should be serving them as them being our customers, so providing transportation to them, but also understanding what our responsibilities were to ourselves. So to give you an instance, I was dealing with a fellow named Gil Booth, who would assign the contracts for carriage to the lake ships and the lake companies. So I was in an instance where I was responsible for operations of a certain charter. Mr. Bennett was away. He'd left this in my hands. We had a situation where we had a labor interruption, and I'm trying to remember exactly what it was. It was, I think it was the grain handlers were on strike, but the Canadian Wheat Board wanted to keep moving grain. Our ships were, you know, fully unionized, so obviously our workers were in support of the grain handling workers. So the Canadian Wheat Board came up with the idea of loading one of our ships direct from train through Thunder Bay terminals. So there they could empty the train car, the rail cars, put the grain on belts through hoppers, and then load using this belt system directly into our ship. So Mr. Booth came up with this idea. There was a charter to do this. Our ship is showing up. And I'm expressing to Mr. Booth my concern that this could affect me as an operator because, you know, my unionized employees may say, well, we're not going to do this. We're going to withhold our services. And his exact words to me were, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. Well, here I am, a young man. I at this point, it was before the cell phone or anything like that. I can't contact anyone else to really talk to about this other than the operations people in Thunder Bay. So our vice, I'm trying to remember, general manager, vice president, Pat Doherty, my brother, you know, what do we do in a situation like this? It resolved itself, but there were sleepless nights.
How did it resolve itself?
We loaded the ship, but we did it with the cooperation of others. With the full understanding that this was a contract that had to be fulfilled, that we weren't in any way, we weren't strike breaking or anything like that. I'm sure there were others who have a completely different view, but we managed to do it. So,
Before we move on from your time with the charterers, any other glitches that sort of occurred during your time or during your time with Patterson's in general that you recall? What can go wrong?
Well, ships being out of position, so you're not on time.
But no major incidents?
Not really any major incidents. The challenge often was setting up weekend work. So you had to have all that done. You had to have all your orders in before 2 p.m. on Friday to make sure, because the ships ran 24/7. So to make sure that everything was going to unfold the way it was to unfold, sometimes the unknown were the saltwater vessels, because they'd be loading in Thunder Bay, but they only wanted to work regular hours. They didn't pay any overtime. They had much different demurrage and dispatch clauses in their contracts. Their sensitivities were completely different than ours. So, you know, if they weren't working, they had to get off the dock. to let us on the dock to continue operating, so to load our ship. So sometimes there was work back and forth with agents and just the ongoing day-to-day full season from, you know, the end of March through to the freeze-up in December or early January, keeping those ships going all the time and keeping everybody.
And during your time with the charterers, you didn't lose any ships? They were all freely floating, and
the story was from time to time, and so some, or you know, have an engine failure or something. That those things happened, but
so how does that? What do you do? Let's say if an engine fails,
well, you try and sub another ship in if you have capacity to be able to do that, or you get it fixed fast. You know, if it's a German engine, you air freight the parts out of Germany. You pay the money you have to pay to keep the ship running because it was a 24/7 operation. That, you know, you did the things you had to do, and you fully understood you fully understood what it took to keep things operating and what the costs were involved. We were all very involved in understanding the operating costs of the ship. That's another thing that Mr. Bennett really helped me understand, was what it cost on a daily basis to run the ships. So you had to know what your margin was when you set a charter. Otherwise, you could lose money pretty quickly. And I made a couple of trades that were pretty slim, and so slim that they were probably break even. And you don't do business to just break even. So many times it was pointed out to me, we're not in the marine transportation business. We're in the business of making money. That you had to be a bottom line thinker.
When you talk about having to be a bottom line thinker, do you have an emotional attachment to ships because of this or no?
Oh, I mean, to go forward in time and to be in my 50s, I was like, I guess around 50 years old or so when we were doing our transaction to exit the business. It was a really difficult time emotionally for me because it was what I did. And so the smell of diesel, the sound of the waterfront, the smell of the water, the contact with the people, it was very, I had a very, very difficult time transitioning out of that after we left the business. There was a lot of emotion involved, there's no question. And as a young man, I didn't realize that. But I was definitely fully invested emotionally in the business, 100%.
Anything more that you'd like to say about the Winnipeg staff? You sort of mentioned generally what they did and that you respected what they did. Mm-hmm. But sort of any people that, for history's sake, you'd sort of like to...
Lots and lots of standouts. I don't want to forget anybody, but maybe if I don't mention a name, it's not as important because... maybe nobody's going to be listening to this for some years, but I learned so much from people like Percy Stapley, who was our legal counsel, Murray Dixon, who was our chief financial officer, so much from Bert Domes, who was the general manager of the grain division, Barry Woods, who was really in charge of grain trading on the trading floor, his brother, Blake Woods, who was, I can't remember exactly what Blake did, but just a kind, gentle man. And some years later, when I had left Winnipeg, I ended up working with Blake. He took over as the editor of the Patterson News. And so I would provide him with the marine portion of the Patterson News. And I worked quite closely with Blake and developed a strong bond with him and a great respect for him. Sam Brooks, who ran the computers in our office, and it was a very seminal time in the industry. We were starting to have to adapt to do new technology. I remember when the fax machine came in, and nobody had ever seen anything like this before. We'd done everything by private wire, which I had referred to before, where we had everything in writing. So not only did we talk on the telephone all the time, we put a lot in writing. Well, the fax machine started to take over from that. And I remember being in discussions with my uncle and my brother Robert, and my brother Robert having to carry the ball on this one to say, Uncle Don, we're going to take the private wire out of the office because we have fax machines now. And my uncle used to see every bit of communication that took place anywhere in the company. It all landed on his desk because so many duplicate copies came out of the private wire. I can't remember, it was four or five deep, and they would go all over the office. People knew what was going on. One of those copies ended up on his desk, so he knew every day what was going on in the company. So we had to find a way to make sure he was in the loop and comfortable with this change. So in came the fax machine. Well, at the same time, computers were starting to come in. At Winnipeg Charters, I started to learn on an Apple IIe. That was the first computer I operated in the Winnipeg Charters office, and it came from Montreal, and it came from the Montreal office. It was like a $12,000 machine because nobody was using it there. They didn't know how to use it. They didn't want it. They didn't like the sound of the printer. It was too loud. So it came to, they put it in a box and they sent it to Winnipeg, and I started to learn how to use a computer, and that was 1984 or 1985. And once that started, there was no stopping. It just started to snowball. So I started this by talking about Sam Brooks, who had come from our mobile home division.
The mobile home division.
We were the second largest manufacturers of mobile homes and recreational vehicles in Canada.
Under what name?
Norcom Homes, and we built holiday trailers. They sold them here in Thunder Bay. We had RV parks that we owned. We had a very large manufacturing plant in Alberta. It was an interesting part of the business. So anyway, Sam came to our grain operation from that side of the business and started, developing information technology for the grain business. It all grew out of that. And so starting to have computers and starting to understand how they should relate to trading of grain, how we would keep track of the trades, and those were very, very interesting times. Mm. Very interesting times.
Did that have any effect on relationships or over time?
Because time it brought in a whole other level of accountability, in timely accountability, because suddenly there was real time documentation of what was going on. It wasn't. This long paper trail. It wasn't, I'll write you a letter, I'll send it by Canada Post, you have time to think about it, and then you respond. It became the fax machine, and suddenly somebody, okay, I'll fax that over to you, and they expected to hear back from you within that day. That was a whole different set of parameters in terms of conducting business, and that must be the same throughout all business in Canada, the world. It was a revolution. It was a revolution, and then along came computers, and then along came, email. And it was an interesting time to go through the evolution of should there be a computer on everybody's desk? And yes, okay, there should be, because people need to be inputting information. Then should that computer be hooked up to what was known as the World Wide Web? Should people have access to the World Wide Web and all the implications associated with that? And then it just snowballed from there. What was productive time, what was wasted time, and because it was new and novel, there were a lot of issues that had to be addressed and policy that had to be designed around that.
And still being done.
Nonstop.
Yeah.
Nonstop.
Yeah.
I have to say, things have really improved. There used to be a lot of nonsense involved, a lot of unproductive information traveling.
Can you give an example?
Yes.
Let's say the unproductive.
Yeah, well, people spending time sending information back and forth to each other about things that were not related to the business. So it could, think about it, it could be anything. It could be a recipe. It could be an inappropriate piece of humor. And that could, at one time it was really in text, but it pretty rapidly evolved into imagery, and then pretty quickly after that evolved into actual video or sound file, and then video. Mm. So it was an explosion, and it had to be addressed, and it was.
Yeah, because that kind of stuff was not happening.
It wasn't part of the business.
Yep.
And nobody had ever seen it before, so there was a lot of excitement, and a great appreciation for how it could enhance the business if it was managed properly.
Yes.
Yeah.
I can remember deputy ministers of government designing charts. They weren't graphic designers, but they could do it with their personal computers, and so, and the time.
Well, and all of us learning how to use spreadsheets, not just to go way beyond just the word processing, because everybody could figure out how to use a computer as a word processor, but begin to actually use it for data storage, data management, and then analysis. They became incredible tools. I used to track all of the statistical information for the marine side of the company in terms of who the customer was, how much we carried, and then what the competition was doing. So we tracked every ship that cleared out of Thunder Bay and what it was carrying. And so then we could really say what our market share was. We could with confidence know and feel that we were getting our share of the market.
Did it lead to any changes? Other than comfort in guessing?
I mean, it was an information tool. We used it to better understand our business and refine our business practice. There's no question that we didn't just collect it for information's sake. It was a tool. And it was the same on the financial side of the business. And Alexander, when he came in, brought us all kinds of discipline that we didn't have before based on really understanding the numbers.
Makes a difference.
Oh, huge difference. I mean, it's knowledge is power, if you will. But knowledge is a tool, as long as you know how to harness it and use it.
We veered off into
very
real impact, and we were talking about personalities. Any others than that?
There were just so many people I came in contact with, but particularly in the Patterson Company. So to be there living in Winnipeg, to be dealing with the managers, and then meeting some of the elevator people too, so the people that were in what was called country operations. So they worked out in the prairie in the various plants and elevators that we owned, and they, you know, to get to know them a little bit, and from very rarely, but from time to time, to go to a new elevator opening and meet all kinds of country employees and get a real sense of the pride in the work they did, to be constantly reminded that we were all very much the same. We had families, we had the same interests and motivations, and see them as people, valued components of our business. And, you know, we used to say people are people are our greatest resource or something like that.
Most valuable asset.
Yeah, whatever. But to begin to really understand what that meant, the responsibility that came with it as an employer, but also to see the value that people brought to the company. That's why we existed, because we had great, dedicated employees. So to get to know them on a personal level and deal with them was really important to me in my growth as a business owner.
The your comments about the prairie elevator people, that shines through loud and clear in a lot of the interviews, that the success, the eventual success of the business at head office comes right back down to having people working out with the farmers who are respected by the farmers.
The frontline managers and giving them then, understanding the importance of what they do, giving them the tools they need to succeed. So giving them computers, giving them training, giving them the things they need to build the business. And we did that on the marine side as well, to try and help our captains and chief engineers with sort of skills development to help them understand the role that they played as frontline managers, the face of the company on board ship.
Did you have training sessions for?
We had meetings every year. We called them our captains and chiefs meetings. We did them every year in January. So after the ships were all laid up, and we would speak to the captains about winter work. About we had every department there: payroll, catering, helping them understand what we were doing, what the new policies were for the next season, helping them see what you know, what food costs were, for instance, so they understood what it cost to essentially feed and house our employees as those ships went up and down the lakes. We would have technical seminars for them on, you know, if it was about navigation or if it was about engine maintenance and operation. Really tried to give them the tools they needed for success.
At the time that you were working with the Marine Group then, would they have all been sort of what you'd think of as professional captains? In other words, they'd gone to school for it, or were you still working with...
I was still working with people who had come up through the system. But it was a mix, because there were lots of people younger than me too that were coming in as management level employees, so captains and chief engineers. So it was a mix. It was a mix. So the old school was interesting, and the new school was interesting.
And what would you describe?
So we're kind of moving away from Winnipeg, but if you want to talk about this for a minute. So old school would be a guy like Hanford Roberts, who is a chief engineer, and I happen to be in Montreal, so I went down to the ship that he was on, and you know, highly, highly competent individual, understood everything, how that ship worked, but also a really interesting personal character from Newfoundland. You know, so he's working on the winter overhaul of these. I think the ship, it would have been a steamship, so it wasn't a diesel. So he's working on the engine room, the things that have to be done for the next season. But at the same time, he's making cod cakes. So the whole interior of the ship smells like cod cakes. And, you know, if you're not from Newfoundland, it might be a whole new smell. So it's the mix of cod, you know, boiling cod and mashing the cod, and all mixed with the smell of diesel and fresh perk coffee and lots of cigarette smoke. We always said our ships ran on caffeine and nicotine, not on oil.
Yeah, well, yeah. Better that than some of the other things they might run.
Yeah, no, there were lots of other things they ran on. So there would be old school. New school would be, you know, some of the younger men who had come up through either the Georgian College system or the Marine School in Quebec, and just taking a different approach.
Yeah. Would you describe one a group as more effective than others, or was it strictly individuals?
It was very much individual, very much individual. And our challenge on the land side of the operation was identifying the talents and encouraging the best performance out of those talents. That's what was important. And again, it's working with people.
Anything you didn't like about that piece of your job?
The dealing with people?
No, the Marine stuff.
The Marine stuff?
What was your least favorite? Usually people say, well...
My least favorite was the adversarial relationship that we had with the Seafarers International Union. It always struck me as being unfortunate, and this was my own belief, I don't think I'm that far off base, unfortunate that the rank and file were led by people that were more interested in money and power than they were in their members. So a lot of the positions they took on things, a lot of the grievances that came forward were really just about the people who were in positions of power in the union on shore. And I don't think they even realized it themselves. But to me, it was a little misguided. To me, it made a whole lot more sense to sit down and try and work things out instead of always having this, you know, us and them attitude. It was always adversarial. By end of days, it started to become a little more cooperative because we realized we needed each other. And I think the rank and file started to understand that their job security was not their collective agreement. Their job security was not their union membership. Their job security was having a vibrant, profitable company to work for. Mm. That's what it was really all about.
Was there starting to be a change in the size of ship crews?
Definitely.
The changes that you were talking about in the offices.
Same thing. It was new technology. New technology allowed with each subsequent negotiation a reduction in crew size. Where we got to the point where we could run efficiently, safely, with essentially the fewest number of people. Because if you looked at the cost of operating a ship, it was 50% human resource and 50% fuel. That's what it was. And then the rest was all the other items it took to operate. You know, your capital costs and your depreciation and everything else. But that the biggest costs were people and fuel.
Okay, this actually leads into another topic that we were going to discuss, but I think maybe before, and that is the renewal of the fleet. But let me just take a look here. So at some point you move back to Thunder Bay.
Yes, so just before we leave Winnipeg, so yeah, okay. I'm learning the chartering business. And so that I moved to Winnipeg in 1984. And I started with the company in 79, moved there in 84, and stayed through 87, moved back here in 87. And while all that was going on, we were transitioning the fleet from a mix of diesel and steam powered to, and from a mix of diesel and steam powered, from a mix of upper Lakers and lower Lakers, to a company that was diesel powered, so they became motor vessels instead of steamships, MVs instead of SSs, and they were all maximum seaway size, so they would be 730 feet long or 222 meters long. That's the transition we were doing.
What precipitated the transition?
It was the competitive marketplace. You know, we had to keep up with the times. At that, and there was some politics involved. We had small ships that were specialty ships that moved feed grains in the upper lakes and that moved other bulk commodities in the lower lakes, the Atlantic, Mediterranean, Caribbean, Arctic. And so it became increasingly more difficult to work in Quebec. For instance, for us to load a vessel in Montreal, for instance, and unload somewhere else in Quebec, in the Quebec Arctic or something like that. And it was, which is crazy because it's a federally regulated industry, but Quebec had all kinds of their own sensitivities. So they'd say, you can't do this. Well, of course we can do this. This is federally regulated. So, you know, you spent a lot of time dealing with things like that that didn't really have anything to do with making money or running the business.
There was still a Montreal office at that time?
Still a Montreal office at that time. So we had all these small ships, somewhat specialized. We used them for feed grains out of Thunder Bay into the Georgian Bay area or to somewhere into the St. Lawrence. And then we used them for the salt trade and things like that and for the Arctic trade. You know, everything from trucks and toilet paper up to Pangerton. Mm. So we began to focus on transitioning the fleet into full seaway-sized vessels. So how did we do that? We made the commitment to build a new ship, 1985. So I was still living in Winnipeg. My brother Robert led the charge on that one, did a really great job on it in terms of getting that, establishing a contract, finding financing. So working with our chief executive officer, chief financial officer, Murray Dixon, and also our legal counsel, Percy Stapley, my Uncle Don, but it was really Robert and Murray and Percy who did that work and built that ship. And that was a big step for us. That was a $35 million contract, something like that. For a private company, access to capital is always the challenge. And, you know, you want to retain your independence. You don't want to bring in new partners, so you have to work with expensive capital. You got to go out and borrow it. We ended up borrowing from the TD Bank, from London Life, Robert can really fill in a lot of that background. I mean, he spent many, many of his working hours on that project. And then also in 1988, so I guess I was already back in Thunder Bay, but it had been going on for a couple of years, Hull Corporation went bankrupt, and in fact, really in contravention of federal regulation, I think it was the Royal Bank kept operating that fleet. That fleet really should have stopped operating when it was no longer solvent, but they kept operating it, and they should not have done that. They should have been forced to liquidate the assets in bankruptcy. Long and short, we ended up in a relationship with Canada Steamship Lines and Algoma Central Corporation to buy that fleet and then split it between us. The only way that that group of companies got together was on the understanding that we would not be allowed to buy a self-unloader. Patterson had always operated bulkers. We'd never been in the self-unloading business. We went through a very expensive and extensive study to look at converting our new ship, the Patterson, that we built in 1985, to a self-unloading vessel, and then fairly quickly follow another vessel, because you couldn't have just one. You needed more than one to perform contracts, to ensure that you could always carry with a self-unloader. So to have a mixed fleet, you had to have more than one self-unloader. Anyway, it was with the understanding, buying the Halco fleet, that Patterson would not get a self-unloader. They did not want us in the business. And there was no extent of negotiations that was going to change that. We needed to renew our fleet, so we bought three of the Halco vessels and operated them. The Cartier Cliff Hall, the Steel Cliff Hall, and the Beaver Cliff Hall. That's what we bought. That's what we operated.
Did you change the names?
We did. We called them the Cartier Dock, the Quay Dock.
Prin Dock? No?
No,
that was before?
No, don't say anything. You'll mix me up. And Wind Dock. Wind Dock, Cartier Dock, and Quay Dock. And anyway, that it, between the building the new ship and buying three new full-size diesel ships and re-engineing our Coma Dock. Our Coma Dock was the old Murray Bay. We bought it from Canada Steamship Lines. It had been in our fleet since 1960s. So re-engineering with a new German engine in the Quay Dock, we had a fully diesel fleet. And so that brought new energy to the company. It brought new interest from customers. It brought new pride to our employees. It was a seminal time. But it also caused us to incur, in total, $80 million in debt. I'm trying to remember what it was. Alexander has probably already talked about this and how extensive and crushing that debt was. These were, by the time 1991 came along, we were in serious, serious challenges as a private family company.
How?
Because of debt.
And was it that at the time that your decisions were made, the debt appeared manageable, or was
yes.
it once you'd committed?
No, exactly. That all of the pro formas we'd done told us we could service that debt. But what was happening in the marketplace? The Russians left the business. They left the business. The Russians bought from the Canadian Wheat Board. We were significant carriers for the Canadian Wheat Board. That left a huge hole. Canadian Wheat Board went from having, you know, six major customers to having to find 200 to still move the same amount of grain. Asia was starting to come on. So the grain trade across the Atlantic was becoming less significant. The grain trade across the Pacific was becoming more significant. The ocean freight market was becoming way more liquid. There was big investment in ocean ships. The largest owners of ocean tonnage in the world were transitioning from the Greeks to the Asians. So world trade patterns were changing. There was a big buildup in tonnage, so freight rates were affected. There was more competition, so prices were lower. So grain trade, grain movement, grain direction in Canada was changing radically. All of those factors, you put all of those factors in, other economic pressures, prices of fuel, operating costs, human resource costs. They were pretty vibrant and lightning fast changes coming at us. Vibrant times and lightning fast changes. So, you know, as much as we tried to plan and work our way through risk, it was a challenge. You know, risk management wasn't really a catchphrase at the time, or a or a focus for corporate life that it is today, but it definitely existed. And, you know, even though we didn't know the term, we spent a lot of time on risk management. And so we went through a huge change in this corporation, and we became much more hands-on owners than we had been in the past. We had to. We had to do more with less as owners. So even though we were pretty much in touch with what was happening in the company, we had to become even more immersed in it.
Can you give some an example that illustrates that?
Yeah, I had responsibilities in the Marine Division, VP of Marketing when I came back from Winnipeg. I quickly transitioned into responsibilities for other parts of the business as well. I became very much, we tried to build the business through some diversification. So we had gotten out of the mobile home business, which wasn't particularly successful, and required a lot of investment, a lot of cash on the part of the company. We got out of that. Some years later, we moved into manufacturing and industrial distribution. So we had been in we had Western Engineering, which we could do our own steel work, and we could do work for others. And it was a business that sort of made money, but also saved us a lot of money because we could do our own work. We had a full fleet of ships. Well, as the number of ships reduced, in order to keep that plant going, we had to look for other business. But at the same time, we got involved in the purchase of Thunder Bay Northland, which was Northland Machinery, which manufactured grain cleaning equipment and also did the manufacture of air handling and conveyance systems for the grain elevators here in Thunder Bay. We bought a business called Bisco, which was part of the same Northland group, which was industrial supply to paper mills, to stud mills, to grain elevator companies, to mines. So we were in industrial distribution. And we didn't fully understand the business. And so really one of the things I ended up doing was presiding over the liquidation and closure of those businesses. We had managers in place that just didn't get it, and we paid too much for the business. And we were very fortunate, because that was all happening when we were having all the marine challenges as well. It was all happening at the same time. So we were very fortunate to have Ernst & Young at that time come in as business consultants, and a man named John
Price.
No, Don Price.
Don Price.
But he brought in an older man from their Toronto office, John, it'll come to me, who didn't really mentor us, because Don, I think, in a way, mentored us, but really sat us down in this room and made us understand what we had to do to stay in the business, to grow the business, to help the business survive and then grow the business.
We're jumping a little bit ahead here of my interview with Alexander, serves me right. So improving the fleet, rebuilding the fleet. Mm-hmm. When you built and bought, I imagine they were larger ships.
Yeah, were full-size Seaway vessels.
So
that's what we were aiming for.
What was the difference in the number of ships then that
So what we did was we
floating.
Ended up with like 8 ships in the fleet. If that number's right, I'm pretty sure it was 8 ships in the fleet. And if we look historically, the most number we had running at any one time was 42, something like that. But we could carry more in the 8 than we could carry in the 42. Mm-hmm. So that's how ships had changed. They were big. A lakes ship is eventually, is not eventually, a lakes ship is essentially a powered barge. It's a big rectangular box that you can put as much in and still have a little bit of water under it to float it. So when you're going through the locks of the St. Lawrence Seaway or the Welland Canal, which is part of the St. Lawrence Seaway system, you might only have a couple of inches of water under your ship. You might only have a couple of feet on each side of it when it's in the lock. So that was your constraint. So the vessels got built to maximize the size of those locks. So that's what they were. And they couldn't go out in the ocean. They were too long and thin with not enough steel in them. The frequency of lake waves is much closer than the frequency of an ocean wave. So on the lakes, the ships are always fully supported. So you didn't need a lot of structural steel in them holding them together. You built this big long box with an engine in it that would carry as much as possible.
I'm interested in the markets that, well, maybe before the markets, let's talk about when you brought in the new ships then, were there certain ports that you no longer went to?
Yes, definitely. And just remind me to talk about the iron ore trade in a second. So yes, it changed what we were doing. We could no longer go into the small ports, but of Georgian Bay or a little place like Port Stanley. We used to put ships into Port Stanley. We used to go to Pelee Island. And heaven forbid you showed up when the deer hunt was on. Nobody'd come and load your ship. You had to wait. So you tried to avoid stuff like that. I mean, those were the sensitivities of operating. So we no longer went to places like that. So we went to, you know, we went in and out of Thunder Bay. We went to Montreal, Quebec City, Port Cartier, Baie Comeau. We went into Gary, Indiana, Chicago, into the integrated steel mills. That became what our trade was.
So when you were talking about chartering then and going up to northern Quebec and over to...
Those ships were gone. Those ships got bought by a company called De Gagné, based in Quebec. As far as I know, they're still operating. They're probably still operating.
So who were the customers when you were... where were the ports of call when you did go outside of the St. Lawrence? Where were the ports of call and who were your customers?
Just before I go outside the St. Lawrence, okay. The customers within the lakes system were, James Richardson and Sons, something called X-Can Grain, companies like that that were trading small feed, lots of feed grain and things like that. Or we were caring for the Ontario wheat producers, so we'd pick up their wheat, deliver it somewhere for export position, or we'd be working for a company called Casco, which is corn starch. We'd be carrying corn for corn syrup, all that sort of thing. We'd be carrying Ontario corn or American corn. We'd be working with the smaller upper lake ships, so the 600 footers, we'd be carrying for General Mills, for Ogilvy, for Robin Hood, so the flour companies or the cereal companies, as I say, General Mills, Quaker Oats, people like that, into Buffalo, you know, for manufacture of breakfast cereals. So that was the kind of customer mix we had then. As the ships got bigger, we moved into the Canadian Wheat Board. People like X-Can or you know, the big kind of Louis Dreyfus Corporation, Cargill, the big grain companies that were moving grain for export position. And then we would move, and then to maximize the efficiency of the ships, try not to run them empty, we had grain downbound, so Thunder Bay out to the St. Lawrence, to Tidewater, and then back up was iron ore. So North Shore iron ore from the North Shore of St. Lawrence for Iron Ore Company of Canada, or for the really it was their ore, but it was for steel customers. So Acme Steel, I get these blanks, Acme Steel, the big steel companies that we were working for. And one thing that happened to us as a company was we went from 500,000 or 600,000 tons a year of iron ore to zero. We lost our customers. And I can't remember exactly why that happened. Robert would remember all that. But he went out, found us more ore, got us back up to doing 500,000 to 800,000 tons of ore a year, whatever it was, so that it matched the amount of grain we were carrying.
Because you don't want to travel one way without any.
Oh, no.
No.
So we got to the point where a lot of the time we were traveling 2 days up to Thunder Bay empty. That was it. The rest of the time we had commodities in the hold that were paying for the operation of the ship.
If you were to look back at that time when the fleet was being rebuilt and what the situation became in the 1990s, without the economics over which you have no control, you know, like the more global economics, would there have been things that you would do differently?
Oh, with the benefit of hindsight?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's one thing that I often still think about this. I was in this office, and I just newly moved. I'm trying to remember if it was just before I moved. It must have been just before I moved to Winnipeg to move into the Winnipeg Charter's operation. Man, names. I can't pull up names today. And I knew him really well. Anyway, the president of Quebec and Ontario came to this office. We called it the Q&O fleet. So Quebec, Bob Savage, I think that was his name, came to our office. He was marketing the fleet. They were exiting the business. Would you buy the fleet? And I think the ask was around $2 or $2.5 million. And with some negotiation, we probably could have paid $1 million or $1.5 million or something like that. The opportunity there. They were direct competitors of ours, and their ships were crap. They were crap, but they still worked. They still floated. They still competed against this. And we talked ourselves out of the transaction. And in hindsight, it would have been brilliant, because when I moved to Winnipeg, we were competing directly against De Gagne, who had bought them, who eventually ended up buying our ships. Our small ships. Well, we would have kind of cut that whole thing off at the pass, we would have had that market, that sort of niche market for small ships, and it could have been a real opportunity for us, a real expansion opportunity to make some pretty serious money in an industry we knew intimately with people we already had in place, assets we already had in place. It just made so much sense from so many standpoints. I can't figure out, going back and thinking backwards, how we talked ourselves out of it.
And how did you talk yourself into the bigger ships?
Necessity. We had to do something. We had ships that, you know, you can keep repairing them, but ours were not full size. We only had the Comadoc. That was the only full size ship we had, and the industry trend was going in that direction. So, had to grab our bootlaces and drag ourselves forward and take huge risk for a company our size to take on all of that debt and try and work our way through it.
The international markets.
Yeah.
So where were the ports of call when they?
We sent ships into places like Tampico, Mexico. And Robert would know way more about those trades. We sent ships. We did some work in the Mediterranean with some kind of clays. I don't know if we took any grains in there. We took, I think we sent a ship to South America at one time. But, you know, Robert would be way more conversant with all of that. That was more his time when we were in Montreal, when he was in the Montreal office working before he came back to Thunder Bay. And you know, at that time I was either newly working for the foundation in Thunder Bay or I was still a student, so.
So, your time in Winnipeg came to an end. How did that occur?
It did. So, my two oldest children, Isabella and Maximilian, were born in Winnipeg. And great place to raise a family, you know, interesting learning, finding my role in the business, tons of support from my wife, Lori. And, but both of us missing where we were from was probably part of it. Having a really young family and, you know, me either working or away, and me transitioning into the next part of my career with the company and becoming more involved in the hands-on operation of the Marine Division made way more sense for me to be in Thunder Bay. And Lori's family was here, her mother was here, you know, young kids, another one on the way. So number three was already on the way when we left Winnipeg. And it just made sense for a whole bunch of reasons. This is where we felt our home was. And this was the part of the business that I was associated with. I didn't see, at that time, see a role for myself in the grain side of the business. So we came back to Thunder Bay, and that was when I assumed the the marketing position, Robert still did a fair amount of that, but you know, we had this built up fleet and it was time to go out and really for me to learn that part of the business and how to fill those ships up. And we were starting to transition, because we were taking more senior positions in the company, starting to transition our senior management people out because they were aging. Mm. So, and then grew into the us becoming much more hands-on managers of the company. Mm.
So what is the difference then between what you did as vice president of marketing with the marine division and chartering?
Well, much different.
Okay.
I didn't sign any charters then. I went out and tried to find customers is essentially what it was. So we were transitioning this fleet to a full-size fleet, a full-size Seaway capable fleet, and that meant pretty large capacity. So we needed more commodity to put in and into those ships, and there was a real reckoning starting to happen on the grain side, as I mentioned, with the Russians exiting the business, the direction of grain movement changing, more competitive to get customers to fill our ships. The same thing was happening in the integrated steel mills and the large steel cos in the United States. They were starting to go through tough economic times. They were rationalizing their businesses. They were being bought, sold, amalgamated. Cost of raw materials was increasing. There was a lot of different things happening in industry at the time, and we needed to constantly renew our customer base there. So that's what I was doing. I was going to, I had people that I was traveling with. One was a fellow named Jim Mitchell, who had worked for the Q&O fleet before, had a marine background. I was traveling with him on the US side. A fellow named Wally Rowan, who was our agent in Cleveland. People who knew the steel industry, and so I met all those people to see if we could develop business with them. I went out to Alberta to meet with people like Fording Coal, which was a subsidiary of CP at that time, to see if we could develop an interest in moving coal in bulk to try in bulk carriers to try and save them some money. They were using self unloaders for their Ontario Hydro contracts and things like that. Going into Detroit to see the people at Rouge Steel to see if they would be interested in using Canadian ships into their plant. So there was that's the sort of thing I was doing. And at the same time, with all the changes that happened in the grain market, we were starting to do more lobbying, for want of a better word, with Ottawa, to help the federal government understand that we were partners, that we all had to work together to continue to develop business for the St. Lawrence Seaway. So I did a whole bunch of advocacy work on serving on industry committees. So I spent time in Ottawa and commons committees, Senate committees, meeting with decision makers, deputy ministers, all of that sort of thing. So what that all added up to was 4 days a week on the road. And so that left Lori alone. Important, that's where I'm getting back to, left Lori needing those supports of home with a young family, friends, you know, her sisters, that sort of thing. So just made a whole bunch more sense. What I was doing, I didn't have to be in Winnipeg anymore. I had learned that part of the business, was actively participating in the marine side of the business, so it brought me back to Thunder Bay.
If you'd stayed in Winnipeg, would things have been different?
Obviously, yes, things would have been different. One thing that Lori had wanted me to consider really seriously was to stay in Winnipeg to take a leave from the business and do my law degree. And she was very supportive of that, very encouraging of that. We only had one child and one on the way at that point in time. And in hindsight, it probably would have made a ton of sense. It would have been perfect time for me to do it. I didn't have all the pressures of being a 20-something. I had a family, a stable life, a business that I was beginning to understand. It might have been a good time for me to go and do that and bring value back to my business that way.
Yeah.
But
always interesting to have hindsight, isn't there?
Always interesting to have hindsight. Because that really was my intention to go to law school before my father had passed away. But then after he passed away, and he was really encouraging me, saying, you know, go to law school. I can get you in. And that's the way things worked in those days. He was a graduate of Osgoode. He was a director of the Toronto Dominion Bank and on all kinds of other boards, and had that kind of influence that's the way things were done. So I wasn't a stellar student. I admit it. It's a matter of record. But I've always been intellectually curious and articulate and talented. I could have done it quite easily, but didn't. So.
Yeah. We all look back at those things that we didn't do.
Sure.
And look back at our lives and say, turned out pretty well. So anything else you'd like to ask about the marketing position that you haven't already said?
No, I think I covered that pretty extensively. It was marketing and advocacy. The CUA was having problems. Trying to get the government to invest in it, trying to compete against the railways. The railways they own their rail bed, but they get huge subsidies. Like, they were gifted the land, and the railways had been advocating with governments for like over 100 years, and they were darn good at it, and they had a huge head start on us. They had legislation that was so much in their favor. They could run at non-compensatory rates and essentially drive us out of business, and it scared the hell out of us. It just scared us, and rightly so. We'd seen it happen in the paper business. They took the paper business, and then the trucks took it from them. Little bit of, stick back in your eye. But the railways, to all due respect, they knew what they were doing. They were good at it. They had talented people. They had a solid position in Ottawa, and they had huge budgets. Ship owners tend to be a pretty thrifty bunch. We had our own offices, the Canadian Ship Owners Association in Ottawa. We were learning how to advocate for ourselves. It was really before there was any legislation about lobbying or anything like that. So you had pretty good access to decision makers in Ottawa, but nobody understood us. We were very negligent at telling our own story. Everybody else was telling it for us, and it wasn't accurate. And so there were a number of coalitions, associations that we put together. So I did that with Canadian ship owners. I did it with a group of ship owners, elevator owners, grain handlers. I worked with Herbie Danaher, who was the head guy of the grain handlers at the time. I came in contact with all kinds of different wonderful people who we all had the same goal, and that was to maximize the utilization of Port of Thunder Bay and the St. Lawrence Seaway system. Made economic sense, made environmental sense, still does today, but it was an uphill climb. Spent days and days and days of my life working on that, which was not a focus on how to make money, but it had to be done. Mm-hmm. So, interesting times. I think of it, I also, we were, there's a lot of transition happening. We were also transitioning into a time of commercialization. So not privatization of federal assets, but the commercialization of federal assets. So the Port of Thunder Bay became the Port of Thunder Bay, owned the asset owned by the federal government, but operating in a fully commercial fashion. We saw it happen in our Canadian airports as well. So I served as, I essentially worked for the minister to commercialize the Port of Thunder Bay. So I chaired the committee that advised the minister, and then I chaired the committee that actually brought forward the commercialization.
What would you say the major changes were as a result of commercialization?
I would say that there was a whole new level of accountability. That was one thing, and that was very positive. A much better understanding of what it took to, in a more competitive, internationally competitive climate, what it took to run a port. So get off the gravy train. Don't spend the taxpayers' money. make sure that it's a viable asset and that it can stand on its own.
It's a great
concept, and it's so much different than the way our American brothers and sisters run their lives. So the easiest way to understand it is when you buy an airline ticket. And they're starting to be more transparent now, but you say, oh, gee, I can fly to Toronto for $99. But then when you push the button on your computer, it's $199, and it's because there are user fees. That's what we were trying to get across to the government in terms of user fees to St. Lawrence. It was a huge economic generator. Why are you charging us to use it? You own the asset. You maintain it. We'll just funnel it, use it like a pipeline. But that's where we always came into conflict. They wanted it to pay for itself. And maybe rightly so. But to go back to what I was saying, the analogy I was making, Americans subsidize everything on the back of the taxpayer. Canadians have this user pay philosophy. I don't know which one is right or wrong. Obviously, the U.S. one stimulates a lot of economic activity, but also puts a considerable burden on the taxpayer. I mean, they burn up a lot of cash, and it's not always fully transparent or accountable. Our system is maybe a little more transparent and accountable because we have the users pay. So we're the ones that are paying. If I'm buying an airline ticket, I'm paying it personally. If I'm running my ship through the St. Lawrence Seaway, then I am having to pay to use that system. So, but user pay, user say. That was our other issue with the federal government. If you're going to have us pay, let us have a say in it, how it's managed, how it's maintained, how it's going to grow, all of that stuff. And that was just a fight every single day with the feds. And it didn't matter what government was in power. It was all the same. It was to have a say in things. Were we effective? Only history would tell. The social historians who are listening to this and analyzing all this will decide at the end. It's history.
So changing over the port to a more commercialized port, what, to the sort of more casual observer, what difference does it make?
I think.
Or what difference was it intended to make?
Well, more accountability, more tangible economic understanding of what it all meant. First of all, getting the burden off the taxpayer. So the federal government was devolving its responsibility, retained its ownership, but devolved its responsibility to those who are actually going to use it. So I guess in a way it was accountability. It was user pay, user say. So the port, for instance, now is governed by a board of directors that represents industry. So it represents the ship owners, it represents the elevator operators, it represents the railways, it represents probably the grain handlers, the agents, all the stakeholders are represented at the table. So that it is actually a much higher level of accountability and transparency now than there was before.
Yeah.
So before it was political appointments. So if the government of the day appointed me and I went in as chairman and, you know, they gave me a great lunch and I had incredible travel. I'd go to Hong Kong, I'd go to, you know, Egypt, look at the Suez Canal. I'd literally travel all over the world and have no accountability, spend a pile of money, and not do anything to enhance the economic viability of that port. The only responsibility I had, if it was really a responsibility, was to kind of have some oversight on the employees. But even that, I don't remember in my day that being particularly accountable. Mm-hmm. So
anything,
it's better now.
Yeah. Anything to add to the story and to history about being director of human resources?
Yeah, it was. It put me really in touch with other aspects of the company. What it really took to keep an office running, to keep everybody motivated, to keep them accountable, to help them understand that every dollar they spend, they should be spending like it's their own dollar. Because that's how you develop a sense of a proprietor, put a proprietary interest in people's minds. How to do more with less, all that sort of thing, you know, all those catchphrases. But to really make it real and tangible, it helped me understand the complexities of people, the sensitivities of people. I worked with the captains and chief engineers. I had a little bit to do with the with the unionized employees, but not really very much. Our marine superintendents, because everything was done by collective agreement, they tended to deal with all of that. Everything was prescribed. The relationship was prescribed. So my dealings were with people outside collective agreements. As I said, I brought us on to full compliance with employment equity. Pay equity was not an issue for us, but employment equity was, became fully compliant.
What did that entail with the Marine Division, and what were things like before full compliance and after full compliance? How did things change?
It was a hell of a lot of paperwork, you know, because it's a federally mandated program, so it's a hell of a lot of paperwork. But I think what it did was it helped people appreciate each other's differences. And I say appreciate them instead of take them in a negative context. So be more sensitive to people who had special needs, people who are from a different culture, people who spoke a different language, anyone who was from the designated groups. So a woman, a visible minority, a First Nations person, or somebody with a handicap. So it just made for a better workplace.
Was your are you talking now mainly about the office employees,
and ships,
or are you talking about ships?
It had to be office and ships.
So was there employment equity on ships?
Absolutely.
There was, or there had to be.
Well, there had to be. It's a federal workplace, so mm-hmm. there had to be, and part of it was governed by collective agreement, but there was also a portion that, as a federal employer, we were required to meet certain standards, and we made sure that they were met.
So how did you do that?
So people could self-identify, for instance, mm-hmm. but they could self-identify in a confidential manner. So, for instance, if you were a First Nations person, you had the right to identify yourself as a First Nations person. But I, as an employer, did not have the right to discriminate against you or, anything. It was all confidential.
Mm-hmm. Did the makeup of your crews change at all as a result?
In my time, not significantly, but because by the time we were fully compliant, we were starting to exit the business. It was a program that came in relatively late. Mm-hmm.
Were there challenges there, other than the paperwork?
And I would say that the greatest challenge was helping people understand what it meant. Because we are so influenced by American culture, when anybody was introduced to employment equity, they always defaulted automatically to, and what's it called on the U.S. side?
Equal opportunity.
Yeah, equal opportunity.
Yeah.
Which they are in no way related.
Yeah, there's another name for it.
Ours is based on merit with a sensitivity, merit and capability and everything else.
Affirmative action.
Affirmative action. There's no quotas in Canada. It is not a quota system. It is a way of sensitizing people to understand the importance of diversity. That's one of the bases that our country is built on. We celebrate diversity. So it was bringing diversity to the workplace in an equitable fashion. And it was ensuring that people were not discriminated against. And so practice is one thing. The concepts are great. Practice, it's like anything else, you've got to work at it. It doesn't happen unless you make it happen. So I think the greatest benefit to us was sensitizing people to our differences and celebrating them instead of thinking there's some kind of challenge or roadblock or mm-hmm. whatever.
Yeah, it's interesting because I imagine at about the same time, while it was happening everywhere, it was happening in the elevators here. And as you said, understanding the concept is one thing, but having it go into practice mm-hmm. was quite totally another, at least for the early years.
There's no question, and you had to be very serious about it and consistent. Once it was started, there was no turning back, and it had to be consistent. And so, if anything, I was the voice of consistency. You think about it, a male-dominated industry, industrial workplaces, just a whole series of circumstances that would make it particularly challenging, but not impossible. And I had a really great consultant that I worked with, a woman here in Thunder Bay, Gail, who her background was as a hard rock miner, but became a consultant, highly competent and educated woman. She went on to help the grain division do theirs. She was really great to work with, really helped me understand what I had to do to draw us into full compliance.
Given that you were involved in that, I have a general question, and that is the grain industry today, from my experience, is still highly male-dominated. Mm-hmm. Why is that, do you think?
I think it's historical. I think it's just, it's no different than any other industry. Look at the banking industry, look at the look at auto mechanics. I mean, any industry you look at, it's what we have inherited, but it is changing. And it's like technology. I think we're going to see an accelerated change. And I see that in young people that I come in contact with. More and more women doing what they call, and I'm making quotation marks here with my fingers. You can't see this because you're listening to a tape. There's the quotation marks. Now I forgot what I was going to say. It was, you know, traditional...
Male occupations.
Occupations. Well, that doesn't exist anymore. The lines are totally blurred, as they should be. There should be more opportunity for women in any workplace. And that was one of the basic tenets of employment equity.
My next item on the list, as far as your work affiliations, was vice chairman of NM Patterson's mm-hmm. and Sons, and then moving on to chairman. So mm-hmm. how did, what shift was there? What caused the shift?
So it's interesting. A lot of those, you know, when I was chairman, I was still doing director of human resources. You know, you had to wear a whole bunch of different hats. We were not a big company in terms of numbers of employees for the volume of business we were generating. So we did different things. So my role as chairman was essentially to chair the board of directors of NM Patterson & Sons Limited. So ensure that we brought good governance to our family business. And by the end of my tenure as chairman, I had completed my, well, I hadn't quite, by the end of that tenure, I hadn't quite completed my professional designation in corporate governance, which I now have.
How does one get that?
I attended the Institute of Corporate Directors at the Rotman School for Management at the University of Toronto, which is their business school, and did all the coursework. And have done all the examinations. So now I have ICD.D after my name. I am a certified, which is an internationally recognized designation. I'm a professional corporate director. Hmm.
What was happening, what years were did this occur then that you moved into the vice chairman of?
So vice chairman, I became vice chairman vice chairman around 1995, and then became chairman by about 98 or so. But I, you know, somebody'd have to look in the minute mm-hmm. books.
So,
but you know what? It's probably on my CV. Mm-hmm. I'm just not recalling it right now.
So Alexander had come back
yeah.
to the fold by then.
Oh yeah. Oh, absolutely. He had left his career with the bank and came to the Patterson Company. And Don Price, who was working with us really closely at the time, tried to talk him out of it, tried to talk us into talking him out of it. He would have had a brilliant career with the bank, there's no question. There's lots of opportunity there for him. But he came into our corporation and was an incredible asset. Just brought all kinds of financial discipline. The fact that he was a family member, that he was our brother, we worked really well together, and we went through some very difficult times, but we worked really well together and met the challenges that a family enterprise meets.
So the reason I was asking now about the years of this was, is that I was thinking back on Alexander's interview and mm-hmm. saying, okay, here's where things really start to change and the challenges really start to mount. So I'm just going to leave it open to you to what you want to say about that time. Because I think it's interesting to see the similarities in what you say and also mm-hmm. some different perspectives because mm-hmm. you're a different person.
Mm-hmm. Did he come to us about 1988 or so, something like that? Does that sound familiar?
It was 1990 maybe?
Yeah, maybe around 1990. Yeah. Okay, so that makes sense. Because I also go, I have moved so many times. I try and picture what house I'm living in at the time because I kind of remember those dates and that helps me figure out what else was going on in my life. So he moved here just before we moved into our house at Crystal Place. So it would have been around 1990. Yeah, so what was the nature of the question?
The nature of the question was when you were moving then from, well, and probably even beginning when you were working in the human resources and vice president, things had really started to change. You had made
this
comment about, boy, we ended up with a fairly stiff
We built a new ship in 85. We bought the three other ships in 88. By 91, the market had completely changed and we had crushing debt.
Yes.
And we had an old country operation. We had no longer had any terminals. We had terminal agreements. We didn't have any terminal elevators. We had an old country operation. And so we had some high throughput elevators, but they were made out of wood. We didn't have any actual concrete elevators on the prairie terminals. So we had an old moldering asset and the markets were changing and we had changed the configuration of the fleet.
So my question was a very general one, saying that Alexander, in his interview, went into great detail about how things changed, what his part was in it, how he saw things operating. And if you would like to do that too, from your perspective.
I think I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
So Alexander brought us incredible financial discipline and a much better appreciation for what the numbers really meant. And that was the area, the focus that the business that he focused on, and it was really important that we recognize what he did. And I've told him this before, but for the public record now, a lot of our success is attributed to Alexander. He had a really good understanding of the metrics, and but I would say his strength was not people. And that's where our success as partners came in. I think I had a better understanding of people. And so I could achieve the benchmarks we set for ourselves on a human resource side, and he could hold the benchmarks and set the benchmarks for us on the financial side. So we worked as a team, Alexander and I, from time to time, because there were employees that couldn't understand his approach to things. And so they labeled it as unfeeling. It didn't have a human element for them. And so I'd like to think that part of my role was translating that. So he gave us the discipline on the financial side, and I helped people understand how important it was and what their role in it was. So, and at the same time, took responsibility for unwinding some of the things we'd gotten ourselves into, particularly Bisco and Thunder Bay Northland. Mm. That I think around, it was between 88 and 91, it was the first time ever we lost money, ever as a family business, ever, and it was on our watch, and it was serious. In one operating year, we lost something like $8 million. $8 million, it was crazy. We'd always been making money, and suddenly we lost all this money, plus we had all this debt. Holy cow.
And
a couple of years, we're going to be out of business.
Like, and this is all in the marine side.
Yeah, because the grain side never really made very much money, but it never lost very much money. And that side of the family, the grain side of the family, so the Winnipeg Pattersons always thought it carried the company. But I think once the day is done and all the accounting is done, it will be understood that the marine division contributed the bulk of the earnings, the bulk of the wealth to the company for years and years and years. Suddenly it wasn't performing. We were in trouble. It wasn't something that another part of the company was going to make up for. It just wasn't going to happen. So, holy cow, we lost all this money. It was a big reckoning. The consultants came in. They helped us understand what we needed to do and how we could do it and supported us in that. And so one of my jobs was to reduce the size of the workforce, the executive side and the management and administrative side. And so people got pretty nervous around here and around Northland and around BSCO if I was wearing a brown suit. And I never realized this, but I was led to understand that every time I was wearing my brown suit was the time that I was showing people the door. So I became the axe man in a way. So our high level, high tier executives, I was the one who sat down and gave them the news that they were being transitioned out, not for cause, but they were being terminated, they were being severed. Here's what it was gonna look like, and here's when you were gonna be gone.
And where was Robert in the really administrative scheme of things?
Really focused on operations. But he was also doing a whole bunch of advocacy and lobbying work and association work at a higher level than I was doing it. So he was the actual sitting member on the Canadian Shipowners Association. He dealt with the Seaway. He did those things at a higher executive level. So maybe less hands-on operational and more oversight. Hmm.
What was his position
title?
So
he was the CEO of the Marine Division.
Okay.
And a director of Patterson's, significant shareholder, as mm-hmm. I was and Alexander was.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you were the brown suit guy, the axe man?
Oh, yeah, the brown suit, yeah. So actually people started to bug me about that a little bit. So I think I found out soon enough that I'd kind of stopped. I had to wind down, and again with a ton of help from Don Price and others, wind down the operations at BSCO and Northland. And also transition people out of employment here at Patterson's as we took over some of the higher executive positions, and then also ultimately when we liquidated the assets of the Marine Division. So Alexander and I did the bulk of that work. So he on the numbers side, me on the human side.
Mm-hmm.
And those were very, very difficult times.
Yeah. I'd be interested in hearing your reaction in specifically, because I think it's quite a story, as Alexander tells it, about the sort of all of the things that came crashing, literally crashing in around the year 2000. So that was the ship.
Oh, 2001.
Yeah. Yeah, 2000 around.
Yeah, so there was 9/11, 2001, which was the World Trade Center. Well, 8/11 was our day. So 9/11 came a month after. 8/11 was the day the bridge operator was impaired, thought that we got spatially disoriented, thought the ship was going in a different direction, lowered the bridge and swept the back end off the wind dock. And unbelievable circumstance that A, somebody videoed it, B, nobody was injured or killed. The captain was probably the only one who was injured, and he got a bruise on his leg from jumping onto a ladder or something like that. We had just repaired the air conditioning on the ship, so when it transited downbound, heading through the Welland Canal towards Montreal, people were inside the accommodation. If the air conditioning had not been repaired, people would have been out on the stern of the ship where the funnel that was swept off crashed down, and the boiler that was inside the funnel crashed down. And it was in the Welland Canal, so that's when people would get off the ship if they weren't on watch and then get back on the ship again as it transited through the canal. So there were fewer people. I think there were only 12 people on board the ship or something when it actually happened. So anyway, that was our reckoning. That was the lightning bolt.
So do you remember when you got the news and how?
Yeah, Alexander phoned me. Alexander and Robert were having dinner together at Alexander's cottage. I had people in my cottage that were over for dinner, and they phoned me and said, turn on the TV. So I did that and then went, holy cow, what's going on? So we had an emergency response plan. You know what? We got to cut it off there because I have to get to an eye appointment.
Ah.
Sorry, I should have. But let's start at that point in time.
Okay.
Okay, will you remember that?
I will start there because
okay,
this is
the emergency response plan. So it will be interesting to compare our notes on that one.
Yeah.
Those were interesting days.